Good morning.
Be seated and come to order, please. Okay.
May it please the court, Rita Pendry on behalf of Xavier Brown, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I might. We are here today on the denial of Mr. Brown's 2255 motion filed pursuant to 28 U.S. Code 2255. The trial court denied our motion on the pleadings with the addition of a file which the trial court reviewed in camera, provided by the government from Immigration and Customs Enforcement relating to deportation proceedings against one of the witnesses at trial, Kendrick Eastman. The trial court considered our claim that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to obtain information, which was readily available, that Kendrick Eastman was facing deportation, and for failing to alert the jury to the fact that he was facing deportation and might therefore have a bias motive to curry favor with the government. The trial court found no prejudice, reaching the second prong of Strickland, as it's certainly entitled to do under Strickland and cases thereafter. The court found no prejudice because the court determined that evidence against Mr. Brown was overwhelming. The court characterized Mr. Eastman's testimony as anticlimactic. The court pointed out that trial counsel might not have been able to shake or impugn Mr. Eastman's credibility, even had he had available to him the knowledge of a pending deportation.
He was already cross-examined on his status as a convicted felon with a plea bargain, was he not?
He was, Your Honor. And
how much really would it have added to that, with jury knowing he's Barbadian, that he is a convicted felon, that he had a plea bargain? How much would it really have added to bring in not only is it Barbadian, but he can be sent back? That doesn't seem to add a whole lot, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I submit it does add significantly for two reasons. One, when he testified in 2006, he had already been sentenced pursuant to the plea agreement he had entered in the Eastern District of Virginia. And apparently, from looking at the plea agreement, which is attached to the government's response to our 2255 motion in the court below, in looking at that plea agreement, his sentence was based upon the fact that he got a 3-point reduction under the guidelines for acceptance of responsibility, and he got another 2-point reduction because he was safety valve eligible and, in fact, avoided the mandatory minimum because he was safety valve eligible. So it looks as if he had not to date offered much in the way of cooperation to comply with that plea agreement. So he's testifying in this trial, and I submit that the jury should have known he had been in this country for 24 years at the time he was convicted in 2003. His mother, we know from the file that his mother lived in this country, and we know that his wife lived in this country. And I submit that if he had been confronted on cross-examination with what would be a natural inclination to avoid deportation for one whose ties are so strong to this country, even had he denied any expectation of favorable treatment, it would have rung hollow with the jury. And I say expectation because I submit that that's the test. The trial judge said that he had no agreement, no formal agreement with the government for leniency or for any help at all in his pending deportation matter in return for his testimony against Mr. Brown. But what's at issue, and it's clear, I think, from Giglio and the other cases that we cited in our pleadings, what's at issue is not whether he has a formal deal, but whether in his mind, there's any expectation that he could be helping himself in his deportation proceeding by testifying in Mr. Brown's case. And we know, even though the matters that he filed pro se himself, trying to take back his plea and claiming that he had been promised he wouldn't be deported, not by the government, but by his own counsel, even though those matters would not have been available at trial in 2006, we can deduce from those filings that deportation was of significant concern to him. And in fact, he later said, I wouldn't have pled guilty had I known I was going to be deported. So I think we can expect similar answers had he been confronted and cross-examined at trial about that pending deportation. And, Your Honor, the other ground on which the trial judge relied was that there was no prejudice because of the overwhelming evidence. And I submit the record simply does not support that finding, that characterization. The record is clear that Mr. Brown was cajoled into coming into the district from Baltimore to pick up money. The record's clear there was no discussion of amount of money. There's never any mention that that money was drug money. And while, yes, the government has that transaction on the day of arrest, that's audio taped and videotaped, there's nothing incriminating in those circumstances. What they have is some loose connection to the person that they have portrayed as the primary conspirator. Their notes in a notebook, all of which are consistent with having been made on the very day he's getting directions to come into the district, and we know he came after four times promising to come in 4 hours or 5 hours late. So I would submit that, and we have Anna Rios saying that she delivered a kilo of cocaine to him from Cholo in December of 2004. She's, of course, testifying pursuant to a cooperation agreement. That's, in essence, without Mr. Eastman, I would submit that is a bare-bones showing of conspiracy. And I would submit that it's Mr. Eastman's testimony about the course of dealing from 1992 through the time of his arrest in 2003, the course, long course of dealing that he claims he had with Mr. Brown, that really put the meat on the bones of this conspiracy. And to characterize that as anticlimactic, I think, is just error. And I think the record bears that out. And I submit that Eastman was, in fact, key to the jury believing that Mr. Brown knew when he finally came into the district to pick up that money that that money was drug money. And there was no other proof apart from, no other direct proof apart from this 404B evidence, this history of dealing that Eastman had with Mr. Brown. So I submit that the court is just in error about that. And I would point the court to the cases cited by the government in its brief to say that there is no prejudice here. The cases that the government cites are all cases where the defendant was intimately involved in the transaction, caught on tape, caught on audio tape, caught on videotape. In one of the cases, the Duke case, the witness about whom, who was the subject of the 2255, his testimony related to a possession with intent to distribute, one count in an 11-count indictment where the primary count was continuing criminal enterprise. So, yes, in circumstances like that, though the testimony of the witnesses, even had they been impeached as the defendants would have liked, might not have been called into question in the eyes of the jury. But I submit we have a very different case here with regard to what was in evidence against Mr. Brown without Mr. Eastland's testimony. And with that, Your Honor, I'll save my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, we'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning, counsel.
My name is Todd G., and I represent the United States. Even if Mr. Eastman had been confronted with questions about his immigration background, as Judge Robertson properly found, there would not have been a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different. Mr. Eastman was an anticlimactic witness. As this court pointed out in its opinion on the direct appeal of appellant's case, the evidence against the appellant was, quote, quite strong. For 2.5 days before Mr. Eastman even testified, the jury heard evidence of his direct involvement in the conspiracy, including from Ms. Rios, a cooperating witness who was confronted with that cooperation. And she testified that in November 2004, she was in Panama, introduced the appellant to the head of the conspiracy, Jose Meneses, and overheard them discussing drug trafficking into the United States. Just 1 month later, at Mr. Meneses' direction, Ms. Rios then visited New York City, and she testified about personally handing the appellant a kilo of cocaine at the direction, a kilogram of cocaine at the direction of Jose Meneses. And then, just a few weeks later, on the date of the appellant's arrest, January 5th, 2005, he is in Washington, D.C., picking up $47,000 at the behest of Mr. Meneses in the dark of night in a McDonald's parking lot. That the jury heard all of that evidence before Mr. Eastman even testified. In addition, the actual circumstances of the picking up of the money on the date of his arrest shows strong evidence of his direct involvement in the conspiracy. He picked up the money in the dark of night. It was when he was arrested, he had another $7,000 in cash on him. He had four cell phones. The last number in his cell phone was a reference to Mr. Meneses. Most very importantly, in his notebooks that were seized from his vehicle, there was an entry in one of his notebooks for Mr. Meneses, a phone number for Mr. Meneses, and a phone number for Mr. Barraza, who was one of Mr. Meneses' distributors in Miami, who was not even involved in the $47,000 cash deal that brought appellant to Washington, D.C. on the date of his arrest. So that notebook entry alone shows the appellant's strong involvement in the conspiracy, reaching out beyond just the date of picking up the money. And the jury heard about all of this testimony before even hearing from Mr. Eastman. On top of that, Mr. Eastman's testimony obviously was still going to come in. It's not as though this immigration information would have prevented his testimony. And even when he did testify, confronting him with this immigration information wasn't substantially more impeachment than was already done. He was confronted with his plea. He was confronted with the fact that he'd lied to law enforcement before. He was confronted with a long history of his drug dealing activity. In closing arguments, appellant's counsel made a strong attack on the credibility of Mr. Eastman. And so he already was attacked, just as in the Weaver case cited in our brief, where this court pointed out that the witness was a minor witness and that the witness was impeached thoroughly. So the extra information that the defense counsel was alleged to have been ineffective for failing to discover wouldn't have had a substantial impact on the outcome of the case. And for all those reasons, Eastman is like that cooperating witness in Weaver. He's an anticlimactic witness. He's almost an afterthought. And he was impeached thoroughly. So for all of those reasons, Judge Robertson was correct after finding out about this immigration information and also saying that there's no reasonable probability it would have had an outcome on the trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, we'd ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Yeah, how much time, Chevrolet? 1 minute. Okay, we'll round it up to two.
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as the evidence the government claims linking Mr. Brown to the conspiracy, there's not even any evidence that any of the other co-conspirators knew him, except Rios' testimony, about which we've talked already, and Barraza, who had made phone calls to Cholo, telling him to call Cholo, and to Cholo telling him to call Brown. There was never any evidence, apart from Mr. Eastman, that his contacts with members of the conspiracy were anything other than associations. There's no drug overtone to any of the contacts except what Rios testified to, and the fleshing all that out that came from Eastman's testimony. And I think the government is just wrong when it says that there is all this evidence of his connection to the conspiracy. There are pieces of evidence which in and of themselves are equally capable of an innocent interpretation, and it's Eastman's testimony of this long course of drug dealing that puts those pieces of evidence otherwise innocuous into an incriminatory light. Government says he was there in the dark of night. My memory is it was about 6 o'clock on the evening when he came to pick up the money. And I reiterate, it was $47,000, but there's nothing in any of the evidence to show that Mr. Brown knew it was $47,000. I would submit that absent Eastland's testimony, Mr. Brown at the trial would have had a colorable motion for judgment of acquittal claim, and it really is Eastman's testimony that flavors all this.
You don't have to establish that, and that's a motion would not have. That's not your best position, counsel. You're going to have to argue. You're going to want.
Let me restate to a better position,
yeah.
And that being that it is clear, I believe, from the evidence that a reasonable jury could have looked at the totality of those circumstances on January 6th and wanted more. And the more was Kendrick Eastman and what he provided about the course of dealing.
You have a better shot that way.
And as to Weaver, Your Honor, the government relies on that considerably in its brief. Weaver was, again, one of those cases. He made four drug deals to undercover officers, and all of those were audiotaped and videotaped. Now, that's overwhelming evidence. I would agree with that.
Okay. And thank I would submit. Well, finish up this minute, and I'm sorry.
One final point, Your Honor, and that is that I think that I would submit that deportation is just different as a bias motive. Living in this country, being the right that it is, and the value that it has to immigrants, I submit that that's a powerful, powerful motive to try to curry favor.
I believe you were appointed on this case. Am I correct? You're appearing pro bono in case. Well, we thank you for that, then. I was going to thank you for being appointed, but I'll thank you for appearing pro bono instead. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all. Cases submitted.